Welcome to the Prophecy Chronicles with your host, Paul Richard Price.
Hello, good afternoon, good evening, good morning, no matter where on the globe you are, it's Paul Richard Price here with another episode of the Prophecy Chronicles show on the UPRN UFO Paranormal Radio Network. And also, I want to thank all of you in New Orleans who are listening to this at 105.5 FM. And we feel for you. I'm keeping you in my prayers about the Gulf oil situation, and I want to thank you all for listening to my show. Tonight, my guest is Dr. Brian Sussman, who is a San Francisco Bay Area media icon for over 20 years. He served as the region's most celebrated television science reporter and meteorologist, having received honors from the Associated Press, the Radio and TV News Directors Association, the National Education Association, and the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. And Dr. Sussman, I won't go into any more of your bio. I want you to go ahead and tell my audience more about yourself, and thank you for being on the show.
Paul, it's a great pleasure and privilege to be on your program. I know some of the other guests you've had. Dr. Corsi, of course, is a friend of mine. We share the same publisher, so I'm in good company here, and I thank you for the opportunity.
Well, and I'm glad that you're on my show. And number one, before we get into the details of the debate you want to do with Al Gore, as well as the book you wrote on on ClimateGate, could you tell us a little bit more about yourself? You were, and are you still, a talk show host in your own right?
Yes, for many years I was a TV meteorologist in the San Francisco Bay Area, and just had an absolutely stellar career as a meteorologist and science reporter. So much so that besides all those wonderful awards I was honored with that you just spoke of, believe it or not, I was actually honored with a Brian Sussman Day in the state of California and a Brian Sussman Day in the city of San Francisco for my work on television. In 2001, I shocked everybody by leaving mid-contract to go into talk radio, and everybody in TV thought I was nuts. Now, they always knew I was a bit conservative when it came to my political leanings, but they had no idea that I wanted to take that and go into a talk radio and talk about all the things that, quite frankly, Paul, I was not able to talk about on television. And that was a big problem. I first became a skeptic of global warming in the mid-90s. And I received, as I talk about in the book ClimateGate, I received so much heat, no pun intended, from my colleagues because of my position on global warming. I was simply a skeptic. And that just did not fly with the orthodoxy of the newsroom at the time. I also worked a lot with the CBS Evening News and Dan Rather, and he was the anchor of the CBS Evening News at the time. And when Dan Rather found out that I was a global warming skeptic, I mean, there were darts that flashed out of his eyes, and he just basically wanted to cut off all relationship with me. So right away I knew that, okay, this global warming thing is more than just about phony science. This global warming thing is like religion with people. So that got me to dig into the details even further, and I talk again about some of these stories in the book ClimateGate to keep the book lively and moving. But also you need to just understand that there is a full-on censorship going on in television and in the mainstream media at large for anyone who does not believe in man-made global warming. And it's the same thing in academia. If you're a PhD and you're working at one of the universities in the United States of America, and it slips out that you're even a skeptic of global warming, you will be blackballed by the staff. And if you don't have tenure, I can guarantee you, unless you're at a couple universities in this country, you will not get your tenure. So it's an all-out assault. It's an all-out censorship. It's academic fascism. But this is the day in which we live, Paul.
Well, and one thing, before we get into the ClimateGate thing, one of the things that I've read in your biography on your website, which is theclimategatebook.com, is the fact that you also believe in adoption. And how many children have you adopted, Brian, at this point?
Yes, I put together a foundation called Brian's Kids, and we have assisted in seeing hundreds of kids transition from foster care into permanent adoptive families. And along the way, my own family has grown exponentially. But, you know, these are some of the critical issues of the day. We've got a lot of kids in foster care who didn't ask to be there, and we need to see about rescuing these kids and getting them into permanent homes. And then the other problem in this world, I think, is the fact that we have a lot of people who are willing to literally have fewer children in the name of global warming. Now, if you want to vary the size of your family, that's your business. But for God's sake, don't do it because you think you're going to reduce your carbon footprint and save the planet from global warming.
Okay, and what I want to do is to bring up a point here. One of my former guests, who is a scientist and an aeronautical and astronautical engineer, Paul Murad, even told me in an email conversation he and I had, and over the phone, that there's really no such thing as global warming. And he's a scientist. He's a well-known engineer and research physicist who told me that even when he worked for NASA, that they didn't really believe that there was anything like global warming. And I think, in my opinion, it deals with more, Brian, than even the religious aspects. I believe that, looking for example, the man you want to debate on this, who tries to excuse himself and not debate you at every turn, and that's Al Gore. He has actually set himself up to be the carbon tax guru of the world. He started his own company to sell carbon credits. Now, I believe it's all money related and to bring forth the agenda, in my opinion, that deals with the New World Order. Now, if you wouldn't mind going and telling my audience right now, since you are the expert, what is global warming and why do you not believe in man-made global warming?
Yes, and we will get into some of your thoughts in a moment, because I share those same thoughts in the book Climategate. And so before I get into the science, let me just agree with you. For some, this is a big money play. Al Gore, Goldman Sachs, venture capitalists in the Silicon Valley, this is a big money play. I'm the first guy to actually document this. I know that Glenn Beck has utilized my book as a resource to get the word out regarding this web of fortune that Gore and others are going to pull regarding cap and trade and the green movement. So that's one big part of it. The second big part of it is a total power play to bring us closer to a new world order. And I'm probably the first quote-unquote mainstream author in that, I have a radio show in San Francisco, and this is a book produced by WorldNet Daily, etc., to talk about Agenda 21 and really break it down in terms that people can understand. Agenda 21 was a UN agenda brought forward at the Rio Earth Summit in 1992. So you've got the New World Order, and you've got an opportunity for some people to make loads of cash. And in fact, many of these people that are about to make all this money realize this may be their last big hit before we have a global economy collapse. So let's place that over there, and now we'll talk about the science. It's very, very simple. I will debate anybody on this issue. It doesn't really matter, because the science is simple. It doesn't square with the scientific record that anthropogenic global warming is occurring, because there's no global warming. That's right. You heard me correct. There is no global warming. And since 1850, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and the end of the Little Ice Age, since 1850, the planet has warmed 0.7 degrees Celsius. Even the most activist scientists out there, James Hansen, Phil Jones, etc., some of these big names you may have heard of, will agree the temperature's only warmed 0.7 degrees Celsius. That's all, 0.7 degrees. Most of that warming occurred before 1940. Yeah, most of the 0.7 degrees Celsius occurred before 1940. Since 1998, there has been no warming, period. So again, I repeat, if you're going to have global warming, you sure as heck better have global warming, and there is none of that. So that's the first point. Second point is, carbon dioxide, up until a few years ago, was never, ever, ever regarded as a pollutant. It's not. It's a natural ingredient for life. carbon dioxide in our Earth's atmosphere is so tiny you can't even envision how small it is. It's 0.38, so it's 38 thousandths of all of the gases in the Earth's atmosphere. That's carbon dioxide. 38 one thousandths. That's it. And of that 38 one thousandths, mankind contributes 3%. 3% of 38 thousandths. I can't imagine a number that small. So carbon dioxide isn't a pollutant. It's a tiny part of our atmosphere. It does not drive temperature. In fact, it lags in terms of where it goes behind temperature. There is no crisis. So they've phonied this up. They've rigged the temperature record. They've rigged the climatological record. They're trying to make you believe that all scientists believe in this particular scheme, and that's a joke. Now, if I could, for just a moment, Paul, let me take you back to 1995, a document procured by Al Gore when he was vice president. He was in charge of the President's Council on Sustainable Development. Whenever you hear the word sustainable development, remember it means one thing, transfer of wealth, wealth redistribution. So he's in charge of the President's Council on Sustainable Development. And one of the things he comes up with is something called the New Consensus Report. And in the New Consensus Report, Al Gore says that we need to, quote, build consensus on difficult scientific issues. Build consensus. Well, last I checked, that's not how you do science. You don't build anything. You let the scientists decide if they want to believe in something or not. The second thing he said, even in the face of scientific uncertainty, society should take reasonable actions to avert risks where the potential harm to human health or the environment is thought to be serious or in peril. Even in the face of scientific uncertainty. So these people know the science is shaky at best, but they're still going forward with their plans. They know there's no consensus, so they're trying to build consensus. And then the other thing that Al Gore said in this document, we believe economic growth, and he's speaking for you and me as American people, we believe economic growth, environmental protection, and social equity are linked. We need to develop integrated policies to achieve these national goals. The environment, the economy, and social justice or social equity are linked as far as these people are concerned. They're using a phony environmental crisis to put forward an agenda to radically change the United States of America and change the governance of the world.
Well, and one thing I want to ask about that, I mean, I'd like for us to go even further back, even before Al Gore, back to the 70s when the green, the quote-unquote green movement or ecological movement was founded by a Canadian who later became Al Gore's mentor. Now, with that, he pushed very hard for Earth Day and others to focus on what he called at the time being, let's see if I can think of the proper word, being good stewards of our ecology in the world. However, since then, that particular individual has been pushing for the carbon credit issue with Al Gore and stands to make billions of dollars selling carbon credits. And we have a president currently who is going to use the Gulf oil spill as a way to push in cap and tax. So that way we will have to pay for carbon credits. Now, I want to go back there and I want to ask you, how much do you know about that? And how much is the New World Order or the Bilderberg Group, whichever term you want to use, how much are they using that as their bully pulpit agenda to bring us into a one-world government?
Okay, let's break this down. And again, this is all in the book Climategate. A veteran meteorologist exposes the global warming scam. And this book is so offensive that while all the bookstores across America will order this book for you, many have decided not to carry it because what I'm saying is just too offensive. You can order it online at Amazon. It's a great place to get the book. Or you can go down to your bookstore and tell them, I demand to receive my copy of Climategate. We've got to get the word out on this. Now, I will tell you, Paul, I concluded one of my radio broadcasts. This is a couple years ago. And Al Gore had just become a partner with a venture capitalist firm in the Silicon Valley, right where I live, called Kleiner Perkins. Kleiner Perkins is the venture capitalist firm that funded eBay and funded Sun Microsystems. They're big, huge players in the Valley. These are billionaires, not millionaires, they're billionaires. And they invited Al Gore to be a part of their team so he could be in on green investment and start laying the groundwork for getting involved in cap and trade, etc. So I just did some cursory research, and I went on the air and said, you know, with Al Gore's new relationship with Kleiner Perkins, he stands to make millions of dollars off of global warming. I received a phone call immediately after that broadcast from a friend of mine. This is a guy I only knew from a charity that we were a part of, and I won't say any more than that. In the book, I call him Dave. That's not his real name. But Dave called me up and said, hey, Brian, I heard what you were just saying about Al Gore, and you don't know anything about me other than I work with the charity, but I'm loosely associated with Al Gore in some of his investments. And I said, you're kidding me. He said, no. And you're wrong about what you just said about Al Gore. He's not going to make millions. He's going to make billions with a B, billions. And he said, I'm sick of this. I want to meet with you. I'm going to give you all the information because what these people are doing may not be illegal, but it's immoral. So I met with him in Cupertino, just outside the Apple headquarters. We sat down at a Starbucks. He gave me a packet of documents, probably an inch and a half thick, and he said, all of this is open source, nothing's top secret, but this is going to save you about a year's worth of research. And what he did was he showed me how Al Gore and others stand to make billions of dollars off the green movement and off of cap and trade. Now, I want to also tell you about this friend of mine. He's been in close quarter meetings with Al Gore, and he actually has debated Al Gore. Al Gore's a big buffoon. He said he's a big, fat, sloppy buffoon, and how he got to this point in life is befuddling to him. I will also tell you a little bit about my friend to give you some credibility. Every time you use an Adobe product, you're using code that he wrote. So he's a very wealthy guy. He's a very smart guy, and he doesn't buy any of this global warming crap. Now, moving on from there, my friend, because of his connections, because he's such a wealthy guy and he's so well-connected in the Silicon Valley, he has met with Bilderbergers. And the Bilderbergers will tell you that they go to the meetings. To them, what's the big deal? Okay, I'm a part of this club. I go to the meeting. And my friend has actually gotten into their brain. He told me the conversation he had with one friend of his. He said, so what's your motivation? When you guys go there, what's the motivation? And the motivation is very clear. Listen, we want to make sure that the world is going to be a good place for us to live. That's the goal. We want to make sure it's a good place for us, the elites, the super uber wealthy, to live. And so my friend talked to him specifically about global warming and the green movement, and this guy said, this is a paraphrase, this guy said, listen, the global economy is about to collapse. All of us really rich people know that, in order to insulate ourselves from this crash, we need to go out there and make as much money as possible. So we're using things like cap and trade and the green movement and other operations in order to gain personal wealth just so we can take care of ourselves and our family. You know, it's no different for them than it is for you and I. We have our jobs. We say, hey, man, I want to put bread on the table. I want to feed my family. That's how they feel as well. Hey, I just want to make billions of dollars to isolate myself when all hell breaks loose so I'll be safe, I'll be cool, I'll be well-connected, etc. So the Bilderbergers are very real. These rich elites are the ones who are running the show with this global warming scheme and scam, and they're pushing it and pushing it and pushing it, and they've hired Al Gore to be their front man, and Al Gore's invested on many, many different levels. And so even though the temperature is not warm since 1998, do you think, and what if the temperature started to cool? Do you think even for a moment that Al Gore would come out and say, well, okay, listen, it's over, mission accomplished, temperature's going downward, thanks a lot, guys. Really appreciate your help. Go out there and have a good life. Are you kidding me? He is so invested in this. He's the front man. He's the PR man. He's the marketing director. He has to go out there and push for global warming because these people stand to make billions and some would say trillions of dollars off of this scheme. And it's all in the book Climategate.
Well, and another thing I want to bring up that we talked about before I got you on air tonight was the mere fact that we can look back at the 2000 election where Al Gore lost, even though he should have won the election. Now, how much of that do you think played into him becoming now the climate czar for the world?
Yeah, for the world. The climate czar for the world. Well, this is how business is done in Washington, D.C. If you're a good apparatchik, if you're a faithful servant, if you take one for the team, whatever the case may be, you're always rewarded down the line. Look at all those in charge of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. I mean, these are all primarily, there are some Republicans, but primarily liberal Democrat operatives who are being rewarded with high-paying jobs. You could look no further than Rahm Emanuel. Here's a guy who has a communications degree from Northwestern. After he left the Clinton administration, before he went into the Congress, he got a job as an investment banker and in about 2 years made millions of dollars. How does that happen? The guy's got a communications degree, for crying out loud. You could look down the line at so many others who have been rewarded with positions at Goldman Sachs and some of the great investment firms, etc. This is how they do things. So I think your theory could very well be true with Al Gore. Here's a guy who, upon running for office in 2000, had a net worth of $2,000. That's it. $2 million. That's all. In 2001, he's recruited to be an advisor to Google. Okay, this is before Google went public. He picked up untold millions of dollars worth of stock becoming advisor to Google. What does he know about Google? Oh, I forgot, he invented the initiative for the Internet. So he's now a big-time player with Google. 2003, he's invited to the board of Apple. What in the heck does he know about computers? He's on the board of Apple. He gets an undisclosed director's salary and significant shares of stock. Prior to that, I should mention, just as soon as the campaign ended, he became a partner with Metropolitan West. He co-founded this very successful investment group. What does he know about investments? Well, I will tell you, just after 3 years later, 2003, he sold Metropolitan West to Wachovia for $50 million. But at the same time, he gets hooked up with David Blood, another Goldman Sachs partner, and founds Generation Investment Management. As of 2008, Generation Investment Management had a portfolio of $1 billion. That was in 2008. It's even more now. They also have a 20% stake in Europe's official carbon trading exchange, and they have a stake in the Chicago Climate Exchange, where we're going to be doing this cap and trade thing. And they're also partners with Goldman Sachs in all of this. And they're partners with the World Bank in all of this. And then in 2007, he joins Kleiner Perkins, the Silicon Valley firm I just told you about. It took Google and Netscape and Sun and Amazon public. And then in 2008, he starts this green growth fund with somebody from Kleiner Perkins, which is worth about $1 billion and has a further investment in the Chicago Climate Exchange, and on and on and on. I mean, this guy is loaded to the gills off of green and future carbon trading. So he is the poster boy. What he's doing is, Bernie Madoff's watching all of this saying, how is this guy able to accomplish this? This is incredible.
Well, and something that our members of the chat room brought up was about how does the green movement work in with eugenics and the eugenics movement?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is huge. And I talk about this in the book as well. So you're asking all the right questions. The eugenics movement, of course, these are zero population people. Look no further than, okay, Barack Obama's chief science and technology advisor is John Holdren. You've probably talked about John Holdren before.
He's the guy, Brian, who wrote a paper about population control.
Oh, yeah. No, he's a big-time eugenics and zero population Malthusian. But John Holdren also wrote that we need to de-develop the United States using the environment through political means. I talk about that in my book, Climategate. John Holdren was a writing buddy with Paul Ehrlich, who's a tremendously popular Malthusian and eugenics advocate. It's scary because Paul Ehrlich, again, this is John Holdren's buddy, Paul Ehrlich. Paul Ehrlich, one of the founders of Earth Day. Paul Ehrlich remains a professor at Stanford. Paul Ehrlich hasn't changed his tune one bit. You can walk in any of Paul Ehrlich's classes to this day and hear what I'm about to tell you. Paul Ehrlich believes overpopulation is like a cancer. And just as you would with a human body that has a cancer, you need to cut it out. And sometimes that can be painful. And sometimes it can be radical. But that's what you need to do with the cancer. So that's what he's saying about overpopulation. It's a cancer. Radical things, strong measures must be taken to eradicate the overpopulation. These people are kooks. They are the antithesis of pro-life. They see you as being not just no more important than a banana slug, but less than a banana slug because you threaten the banana slug's existence. These people are frightening, and Barack Obama is surrounded by kooks like this.
And what does that tell you about Barack Obama himself? Is he, and are they using this particular Gulf oil situation as a sick, demented way to push forward cap and trade?
Yes, absolutely. They're taking advantage of a crisis, something we know they love to do. The Senate energy bill has nothing to do with oil spills. Nothing. Zero. Nothing. The Senate energy bill, the House energy bill that's already passed, the goal is threefold. To reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 83% by the year 2050. Now, just looking at census data, by 2050, we'll have 100 million more people in the United States, 100 million more. You're going to decrease greenhouse gases 83%. Here's what that means. The entire manufacturing sector will be shipped offshore. That's called redistribution of wealth. The entire livestock and dairy industry will be shipped offshore. That's called redistribution of wealth and putting our land back into a natural state. Also, we're going to have the price of everything go up because of these taxes on carbon and energy, etc. Now, how do I know this to be true? Well, all you have to do is look at the legislation. In both bills, there are provisions for anyone making, in the Senate bill, $64,000 a year for a family of four. Because the cost of everything's going to go up, they're going to give you shut-up money. You'll get a check in your banking account every month, or it'll be settled at the end of the year, depending on your income, with the IRS. But you are going to get money from Uncle Sam to handle the cost of living increases in the United States. That's called bribe money. It's called shut-up money. It's called a payoff. Second thing that's going to happen in this bill, if you lose your job because it's been offshored, you will get 3 years' worth of unemployment at 70% of your last paycheck, plus job retraining, plus you will get relocation paid for by Uncle Sam. That's in the bill. Our manufacturing sector, the coal industry, and livestock and dairy will be shut down. Millions of jobs will be lost. This is the goal. Develop the United States. Dumb us down. Make us more like other countries. And then privacy and liberty will be attacked. The only plan they have for energy in this country is for you to use less. That's why if this bill passes, it will be the fait accompli. Started with the 2005 energy bill, continue with the 2007 energy bill, was funded with the stimulus package, will be completed with the 2009 energy bill, which is now the 2010 energy bill. What am I talking about? The smart grid. I'm the first person to write about the smart grid and tell you how this operates. And let me tell you something. You want Big Brother in your house? Go ahead. Support this Senate energy bill. Because Big Brother will be there switching off your lights, your big screen TV, your washer and dryer, changing the temperature on your thermostat. That's what the smart grid does, ladies and gentlemen. It's not about better wires. It's not about bringing broadband into rural areas. It's about controlling you.
Well, and, you know, I'm currently writing the final book in my series, The Prophecy Chronicles, which is kind of the basis for the talk show. And I'm working on a storyline dealing with what I call the high technology or mentality, where certain government agencies as well as individuals and companies in the private sector are thinking about connecting all of us, not only mentally and physically, to a grid, to where we're all interconnected physically as well as socioeconomically into a hive collective.
Well, this would make sense, and the the smart grid could well be a big part of that, and I'd love to be able to read your research on this, because you may be tracking in a very, very real manner, and I don't doubt that at all, because when you hear what these people have planned for us, it boggles the mind. But you just mentioned the hive mentality. A part of what they're going to plan to do out of all of this, of course, and I'm sure you're going to be writing about this and you know about it, but the whole idea that you will turn the United States into basically a giant open space, get rid of all the small villages and towns, get rid of all the farmers and ranchers, move everybody gradually into urban hubs, whereby they'll be living in condominium-type complexes with retail in the bottom, a residential up above, next to a transportation hub, and that's the way we're going to be live. And we will be connected via the Internet and electronic means, and we will be controlled via the Internet and electronic means, controlled via the amount of energy we're able to use, controlled via the amount of health care we're able to receive, and controlled also because at all times Big Brother will be looking in your house via the smart grid, and also what Big Jan Napolitano is calling right now for, and that's a total invasion of privacy via these new Internet regulations that she's pushing.
Well, also, let me bring up a point that IBM has been talking for years, in particular, Brian, about interconnecting the man with the machine.
That wouldn't surprise me, because what you have, and I talk about this in the book ClimateGate, right now we have these smart meters that have been attached to most of the houses in California, where they're able to read your electric meter remotely, but more importantly, it's able to determine how much energy you're using minute by minute, so they can bill you higher during the peaks. That smart meter will eventually be attached to something called the home area network that IBM and Microsoft and Google are racing to build. This will be basically connected to every electronic device in your house. Now, if you wanted to take that a step further, Paul, with nationalized health care, wouldn't it be smart for them to use this home area network to start tapping into your bodily functions just to check upon your health at all times? Certainly not out of the question.
Well, what about mind control as well?
Well,
to create and using this technology, in effect, for as a way to make people more docile and more controllable, where
sure.
They could implant that technology inside of us under the guise, Brian, that what they would do with that is that, hey, you got this chip on you, you don't need a driver's license, you don't need a credit card, you don't even need a key for your house. Just scan your hand and bam, your door comes open, scan your hand, you pay for your furniture, your groceries and everything else, and scan your hand, and you can turn it on and off your car or your TV or any other appliance.
Sure, and scan your hand, and we'll be able to determine all of your health records in an instant and see where you fall in that particular line. And scan your hand, and we'll know exactly from our psychological profiling if you are one of those parents that teaches your kid about God, or if you're one of those parents that believes in spanking. Or they'll have the whole ball of wax on you. And, you know, the problem is when we live in a society where we have people who are so scientifically illiterate and so illiterate in terms of their knowledge of world history, we are ripe for the pickings. And that's why Karl Marx, and I talk about Karl Marx at length in my book. I understand this is a book on the environmental movement, global and global warming, but we got to start with the originator of all this, and that was Karl Marx. And Karl Marx believed that history meant nothing. So what a way to make a population docile so they'll just go along with the program. Oh, sure, a little chip under my skin. Hey, wow, cool, that's technology, man. Well, Karl Marx knew that if we had access to history, we would look back upon all the other civilizations that came before us and realize there was this ebb and flow that we need to avoid, lest we become the next once free society to become led by a tyrannical dictator. And if we don't stop this madness now, we are certainly going in that direction. So that's why I wrote ClimateGate. I want people to see what was in this energy bill that now the Senate is trying to pass. We've got to stop this, because this is one element whereby they want to, in very real time, and we're talking the year 2010 here, they want to start controlling greater portions of our life, Paul.
Well, let's go back to what our founding fathers in the documents they wrote, the Federalist Papers, Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, and the Constitution, what they actually had tried to get us to do, and that was to, number one, think independently. Number one, do not always trust your government.
Yes, that was one of the... They feared an overreaching federal government. And you mentioned the Federalist Papers. This should be an exercise for every American to read the Federalist Papers and understand what the founders were thinking when they crafted this Constitution. But again, you know, we live in a day and age where our finest universities, supposed finest universities, don't even teach Western civilization. You go to a constitutional law class these days, or if you major in constitutional law, you don't even read the Federalist Papers. So they provide us with an understanding for what was taking place in this wonderful experiment called America. And you're exactly right. A federal government is to be feared. That's like the famous Ronald Reagan line, you know, the most dangerous seven words. I'm from the government and I'm here to help. So I guess that's eight words. The eight words you should fear: I'm from the government, I'm here to help. We do not want the government in our lives, but we're at a point in time where, you know, people, oh, health care, oh, yeah, gosh, we need that now. Energy bill, oh, sure, I'll go, I don't want pollution. Well, it's not about pollution, folks. It's about controlling your life. It's not about pollution, folks. It's about making sure that you have less energy to use. You know, Paul, in this energy bill that Obama's really going to push hard for, there's nothing about alternative energy here. And the federal government has denied 130 applications to put solar arrays on federal land. Why? For environmental concerns. Wind power. I live next to the largest wind farm in the world. It's here in the Bay Area. It's been here since the 70s. Nobody even knows this. Largest wind farm in the world is in the San Francisco Bay Area. Since the day that wind farm went online, there has been lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit to stop it and shut it down. Who are those lawsuits filed by? Are you ready for this? They're filed by environmentalists. The environmentalists can't stand the wind farm. It takes up too much space. It kills birds with those turbine blades. So wind, solar, it's a joke. Okay, now let's move on to nuclear. Nuclear is a great form of power. Nuclear is very, very safe. It's very efficient. It's very cheap. Obama, March 30th, said, "Oh, we're going to give a little. We're going to give some low interest loans to the nuclear industry. We're going to get some nuclear power plants built in Georgia." Oh yeah, right. He also said that this will be based upon sound science and environmental concerns and safety concerns. Well, guess what has stopped the nuclear power plants from being commissioned in this country since the 1970s? None have been commissioned since the 1970s. A few have been completed, a couple have expanded, but none have been commissioned for building since the 1970s. You know what has stopped that? It's been environmental and safety concerns. We're not going to see any nuclear power plants built in this country anytime soon. We need a couple hundred, but we're not going to get a couple hundred, because at the end of the day, as I quote in my book, one of these friends of Obama has said, to give the American people a cheap and abundant source of energy is like giving an idiot child a machine gun. That's what they believe. They don't want you to have extra power. They want you to have less. More power means more development. More power means more capitalism. More power means more materialism. More power means more liberty. They don't want that. So they're not going to allow for it. So now we have fossil fuels. They want to shut those down in the name of greenhouse gases. And what does that leave us with? It leaves us with nothing. And that's their goal.
Well, and another thing I'm wondering, I mean, I live in an area where I know that one of the greatest proponents of, you know, the climate issue and also of eugenics owns property here, and that's Ted Turner.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Ted
and
Turner.
I live in Bozeman, Montana, and he owns property here. And he's the largest landholder, single landholder, I think, in America, if not in the world.
Yes, he owns, as you know, well, first of all, you live in God's country. I love Montana. Whoa, what a great place. I've spent a lot of time in Montana, spent a lot of time in Helena. We can get into that in another conversation. But bottom line is, Ted Turner is a eugenicist. He's a zero population growth nut. He's a global warming enthusiast. He's an elite. He's a very wealthy man. He believes that he's smarter than you are. He believes that he's better than you are. This is a guy who, if I remember correctly, in fashioning his property, actually moved a river. It's okay for him to move a river on his property, but God forbid that you even, go in a river on a hot summer day and take a leak because you just want to. That would be a toxin. He gets to move an entire river, and that's okay. These people, you know, it's all about some people are more equal than others, and that's Ted Turner. He comes from a great line of Marxists who have believed, like Karl Marx did, that some people are spit out of their womb with a better brain than others, and those with the better brain have a right to rule over those with a lesser brain, because those with the lesser brain will kill one another or destroy the planet or both. That's what Karl Marx believed. That's from his laws of matter, which I break down in my book, Climate Gate, and it tells you the origins for the people like Ted Turner of the world. And I quote Ted Turner a lot in this book because he's an absolute kook. This guy should probably be in a mental hospital, and I'm sorry to hear that he's your neighbor.
Well, and as you know, he runs Ted's Montana Grill restaurants where he kills bison and serves them for dinner, basically. But the thing that gets me about Ted is that Ted says we shouldn't have, you know, large families and all, but he's got about four kids of his own.
Yeah.
Yet he would not allow any of the rest of us the opportunity to have more than one, possibly two.
Possibly two. He's talked about the size of families. It's really interesting, isn't it? Al Gore is another one of these buffoons who, lives. He just bought a new house, and before they decided they were going to split up, he and Tipper bought a new house in Montecito next to Oprah's house near Santa Barbara worth $9 million. It has a carbon footprint of probably 20 normal size houses. He's got that pad in Nashville that uses 10 times the electricity of anybody else, and it's supposedly green. In fact, when he refashioned the house to become green, it ended up using more power than it did before it was green. He's also got a really slick pad in San Francisco, complete with butlers and maid service and all this kind of stuff. And I've always thought it was hilarious because should the sea level rise, as he says it's going to, that place in San Francisco is going to be underwater. So he's got that pad. He's got his place on the former zinc field in Tennessee, and I'm sure he's got a place in Washington, D.C. as well. This guy's as phony as baloney. He tells all of us how to live, and his carbon footprint is probably 100 times larger than mine and yours combined.
Well, one thing, I know that we agreed only to a certain amount of time, but I'd like to give our audience a chance to ask questions and then do some interaction with you, if you wouldn't mind.
No, that'd
staying
be great.
A little
be,
longer.
Be great. No, it's my privilege, my friend.
Well, thank you. One thing I wanted to bring up about Al Gore is, yes, he has done that, but he won't debate you. Why?
He's fearful of debate because he knows he doesn't have the facts on his side. He knows he can't win in the arena of ideas based upon fact. We were talking about this off air, and I took 200 readers of my book Climate Gate down to Monterey about a month ago, because he was speaking to the Panetta Institute. Now the Panetta Institute is, as in Leon Panetta, our director of the CIA, which was a nice political payoff to Leon Panetta. Here's a hack former congressman from nowhere who's now in charge of the CIA. That should be frightening to all of us. But Al Gore spoke at the Panetta Institute. It was at a theater in Monterey. And so I just put the call out to readers of my book. Got about 200 people showed up. And we had a nice little welcoming committee for Al Gore. Amongst other things, we had a chant that was going, debate, debate, debate. It was really fun and just great fellowship and camaraderie. Well, little did we know that our chant for debate was actually heard inside the theater, and it interrupted Al Gore during his speech, and it became so embarrassing he had to say something. And what he said was, and I quote, "I wish with all my heart that the deniers were right, but they're not." And he received an ovation from the audience and just continued. In other words, we're not right, end of argument. There doesn't need to be an argument. I'm just right. That's what he believes. Well, the fact is, I've got the facts on my side. And I will debate any one of these buffoons on this issue anytime, any place, anywhere. Al Gore, bring it, man. Ted Turner, you're in the sound of this radio station right now, and the sound of our voice over the Internet. Come on, you buffoon. You're a big dope who's loaded with cash. And I think all of those years of being an alcoholic impaired your thinking to the point where you actually believe in anthropogenic global warming. Al Gore, I don't know what the heck's wrong with him other than the fact that he is one of the most greedy sons of guns you'll ever meet in your life. And what he's doing may not be illegal, but I'm telling you, it is immoral, and he will be judged for that. You can go right on down the line with all these left-wing activist hacks who are manipulating data for a political cause, and shame on each and every one of them. I'm not getting anything out of this. I get nothing out of this. I have no political agenda. The only thing I want to do is see the truth exposed, and I want to see my country saved from this nonsense. That's my agenda. I want to see the truth exposed, and I want to see my country saved from going to hell in a handbasket because of the agenda that these people are pushing.
Well, and I'm glad to hear that, and I want to encourage, and if you don't mind me asking you, Brian, how long can we have you into the next hour so we can get the audience to start asking questions?
Do you have any breaks coming up? How's your format work?
Break on the top of the hour, and that's the only break until we go into hour two.
Okay, good. I can go, right now I can go till 6:20. So I can do another half hour.
Okay, great then. And if any of you want to ask Dr. Sussman any questions, please feel free to write them down, you know, in the chat room, and I will refer them directly to Dr. Sussman. One thing I wanted to ask you, Dr. Sussman, it's been said that if we here on Earth have had a problem with quote-unquote global warming or climate change, so has Venus, so has Mars. My gosh, man, I didn't know that whatever we did here on Earth had that grandiose of an effect.
I've always thought it was hilarious that as we've seen our temperature warm, again, since 1850, about 7/10 of a degree Celsius, that's all, and there's been no warming since 1998, and most of that warming came before 1940, as we discussed earlier in the broadcast. So 0.7 degrees Celsius, which is roughly 1.1 degree Fahrenheit. While we've seen that warming, Mars has almost seen an exact same warming. Now, why is that? Is that because of the greenhouse gases that are being emitted by the Mars rover? Come on, this is a joke. It's because of the sun. You know, if you want consensus regarding global warming, all you have to do is look no farther than the astrophysicist community. These are the people that study the sun. And they are in unanimous consent regarding what's causing climate change at any point in the Earth's history, and that's the sun. The sun is a big ball of fire that it varies in its radiation capabilities. Sometimes it's a little hotter than others, just to put it simply. So the astrophysicists all recognize this. They realize, yeah, well, it's the sun that causes temperature changes. It's the sun that causes climatic changes. And they also recognize, and I get into this in my book, Paul, and I wanted to keep this simple because it can get really, really out of hand quickly in terms of just becoming a pretty cold read, no pun intended. But that is the Milankovitch cycles. The Earth travels around the sun in an ellipse. It's not a perfect circle. As we travel the sun, it's not a perfect circle. It's an ellipse. And so, as a result, as we get farther away from the sun in our rotation around the Earth, we're obviously going to see cooler temperatures come about. So this is the Milankovitch cycles. Right now, we're in the perfect place. We're just, we're in the perfect zone for habitation. But you give us another 10,000 years or so, and this Earth is going to get cold. We're going to see another ice age. The glaciers will advance. Human habitation is going to become very difficult. That's just a fact. It's based on the Milankovitch cycles. Now, if I were to talk to that about Al Gore, he'd probably say, oh, yes, well, I know you flat earthers believe in these things called the Milankovitch cycles. If I said it to that dope Ted Turner, he'd say, Milanko, what? Is that some kind of vodka? What is that? These people are clueless. These people are clueless when it comes to the real science. And so I try to break down the Milankovitch cycles in ClimateGate because I really want people to understand, you know, what really drives the temperature of planet Earth.
Well, one thing I want to bring up, too, I've gotten a note from my producer, Joe Montaldo, that he said that we're going to skip the break and we can go on into the next hour without any interruptions, if that is okay.
Perfect.
You, Brian.
Perfect.
Great. And I want everyone to go ahead and ask any questions. I don't care how, you know, if you agree or disagree with Brian and what he's saying, please ask. You're here to learn. That's why I have this show. I want all of my listeners to be able to come out of this with more than what they came into it with. And let me ask you this one thing really quickly. So do you think that this will eventually lead with what the global elite is currently doing, Brian? Do you think that this will eventually lead, Brian, to a total collapse of the world economy to where that they can set up what they call a one-world global economy based on the pretty much on the ecology of the planet is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I think if you talk to people in the know, and I try to have as many conversations during the course of the day as possible with people who are experts in various fields. I think everyone's on the same page here. We all have this, especially as Americans, we have this inherent ability to be optimistic. I mean, this country was founded on optimism, and liberty is very optimistic. And so we're all very optimistic about the future. The problem is, when you talk to experts and they're very candid with you, they will admit that we have a situation where the economy of the Earth is, the economy of the world is really in a perilous state, and we're starting to see signs that we could have an entire global economic downturn. Virtually every country is overextended right now. Most people on this planet find themselves in an overextended or underfunded situation. So we're on the brink of some kind of economic catastrophe, and we can try to put lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig. We've got a very serious situation right now. So I believe that there are a lot of these people and proponents of global warming who see this as their last hurrah. They're seeing, okay, listen, we're not going to have opportunities to score big bucks on the stock market any longer. We're not going to have big opportunities to make our money in investment banking as we know it. Let's come up with one last hurrah, and that is this cap-and-trade scheme. The Senate Energy Bill, the House Energy Bill. It's amazing to note how many hundreds of pages are dedicated to the establishment of a trading exchange for carbon. And when we talk about trading carbon, these carbon credits, I'll just explain to you how it works in case some of your listeners are not familiar. You're going to have bureaucrats at the EPA looking at every business in America, every industry in America, and saying, okay, this is how many how much carbon dioxide you're going to be able to emit every year. Whether you're a surfboard manufacturer, whether you're whether you do barbecue, you know, maybe you barbecue ribs for a living, or maybe you're a full-on coal-generating power facility. They're going to determine what your CO output is allowed to be. If it's determined that you exceed that output, or that cap, as it's called. See, that's the cap. They're capping your carbon dioxide output. If it's determined that you exceed your cap, and they'll have ways of figuring this out, it's going to be some bureaucrat with a clipboard and a little G-Man badge that comes to your place of business and tries to figure this out, but then you'll have to buy credits on an exchange, and that'll be the Chicago Climate Exchange. Al Gore's already invested in the Chicago Climate Exchange. And what's really scary, Paul, and I show this in my book, Barack Obama, before he was even elected into office, was involved in the foundation of the Chicago Climate Exchange. It's really weird. But I digress. So now getting back to this. So you're a surfboard manufacturer. You're a coal-fired generating electricity facility. You're a car manufacturer. Maybe you do auto body work. You exceed your carbon limit, you're going to have to buy credits on an exchange. Those credits will be subject to laws of the market, supply and demand. They could be very, very expensive because these credits will allow to be bought on the exchange. They'll allow to be sold, stored, shelved, hoarded. Derivatives trading will be allowed. It'll be just like money. So you go to the exchange, you say, okay, I need to buy some carbon credits. How much is that going to cost me? And you might be shocked to know that you can't afford the cost, but you got to buy them. Otherwise, there's penalty of law. You'll end up going to jail. So you'll buy these carbon credits. You'll suck it up, and you'll end up passing the cost of doing business on to other people. Well, guess what? For each one of those carbon credit exchanges, there are going to be people skimming. They're going to be making their commission. It's like using E-Trade or Charles Schwab or one of these other trading facilities. There's always a commission. There are going to be commissions paid for each one of these carbon exchanges. You're going to end up buying some of these carbon exchanges from bankers, you know, guys like Al Gore. Al Gore's company is going to hoard these things. They're going to buy them up from people who didn't use all of theirs. So you're going to be going to Al Gore and company saying, listen, please, I want to keep the business. I want to keep the business. I got to buy these, man. Give me a good price. And they'll look at you like a little peon, and they'll say, you're not going to get a good price. You're going to get what the market bears. Here, buy them at this amount. And you'll say, but I can't afford it. We're going to have to close. I'm going to have to close my business. I've worked so hard to put this business together. And they're going to look at you like a little peon and they say, be gone, you fool. Because they know that this is their last big opportunity to make bank. And they will not care about your little business. They will not care about your large business. If you don't like it, tell you what, why don't you go to another country and set up shop, because that's the only way you're going to stay in business. This is the plan, Paul. It's frightening to know what they have planned. But they're planning this because this is their last great hurrah as the global economy possibly comes to an end.
Well, one thing that our audience is asking, Lily in the audience wanted to know, is how do you see the Gulf oil disaster, let me go back up here and read it, fitting into your predictions for 2050, is what she's asking.
It's a great question. Well, let's talk about what we know about the Gulf disaster, because there's so much we don't know. And those of us who like to speculate could probably think, well, you know, Paul, if you and I were off the air, we could probably really start to use our imagination of what might have happened with this Gulf oil spill. So let's just talk about what we know. What we know is that BP, British Petroleum, they were huge donors to the Obama campaign. We also know, I found this out and I wrote about it at AmericanThinker.com a few weeks ago, British Petroleum gave University of California, Berkeley, a grant for $500 million. And that grant was put together by Stephen Chu, Barack Obama's energy secretary. So this administration's in bed and beholden to British Petroleum. So what I think happened, again, I don't know how this oil leak began. But my guess is, initially, the Obama administration's ridiculously slow response was based on this. They probably thought, listen, this is bad, but these are our buddies at BP. You guys got it handled, right? Just take care of it. We're not going to make a big deal out about it. It'll probably take a few days, maybe a week, and just get it handled. Well, guess what? A few days, a week, nothing happened, and then the administration had to start playing catch-up. And they didn't employ the plans that were in place. We had a 1994 piece of legislation on how the federal government will react to a spill of this nature. We had laws put together after Exxon Valdez in 1990 saying, listen, if you're an oil company, this happens, you got to pay for the cleanup, and you have to pay for all the liability. So those plans were on the book. There's no need for a $2 billion fund. There's no need for any of this shakedown stuff that Obama's now doing with EP to try to make it look good. The bottom line is we already had laws in place to cover all of this. So the Obama administration has dragged their feet. They didn't employ the plans that were already in place. I don't know what they were thinking. I don't know what their motivation was, but I can tell you what it is now, and that is take advantage of a crisis. So they're going to use this opportunity to shut down oil and gas exploration in our waters off the Gulf Coast forever. You heard me right. They will not allow for any more drilling off those waters forever, ever. How do I know this? Well, 1969, there was an oil spill off the coast of Santa Barbara here in my my state of California. That oil spill gave us Earth Day. It was an oil spill in 1969 that started Earth Day. That 69 oil spill, which was puny in comparison to what's going on in the Gulf, has shut down, not shut off, shut down, oil and gas exploration up and down the entire West Coast ever since. It's been over 40 years. We have not done any new oil or gas exploration since 1969 up and down the West Coast. Okay? That's how long-suffering these people are. 69, it's now 2010, we've had no new oil or gas exploration on the West Coast. Look at Exxon Valdez, 1989. That wasn't even a rig. That was a drunk captain of a ship. Ran aground, dumped 250,000 barrels of oil, and that area has been shut off since 1989. President Bush tried to reopen that area in 2007, but Barack Obama quickly closed it back down in 2009. So these people are long-suffering. They're going to take this oil leak, and they're going to use it to shut down oil and gas exploration in the Gulf. Why? Because they don't want us to have oil and gas, because they want to dumb down our way of life and our standard of living. Now, I have to tell you, Paul, you're up there in beautiful Montana. I'm out here in the land of kooks and fruits and nuts, California. I was speaking with a gentleman today on my radio show. His name is Umberto Fontova. He's written a lot about communism because he used to live in Cuba. He lives on the Gulf Coast in Louisiana. Guess where he was this weekend? He was having the time of his life fishing in the Gulf. He said, Brian, you're not getting the whole story, sure. Yes, sure, the Gulf spill is bad. It's awful. It's no good. But most of the Gulf is open for fishing. He said the shrimpers are out there. You're not hearing that. Shrimp fishermen are out there. Oyster guys are out there because parts of the Gulf have been completely untouched by the spill. And as he reminded me, 500,000 barrels of oil are exuded naturally from the bottom of the Gulf floor every year. So he said, yeah, it's bad, it's not good, but what they're not telling you is most of the beaches are not affected by this oil spill. Most beaches are not affected. Most fishermen are still able to go out. Most shrimpers can still do their thing. Most oystermen can still do their thing. So again, we're getting really bad reporting on what's going on in the Gulf right now, and I think the Obama administration is enjoying that fully.
Well, and I have another question from Solomon in the chat room, which doesn't necessarily deal with this subject, and I hope you don't mind me changing midstream here to get a question answered for him, because you are a noted expert on science.
Yes.
And he wanted to know, how does the genome mapping and the work of J. Craig Venter relate to synthetic bacteria as basis for the supercomputers needed for deciphering of the so-called junk DNA in humans? And how does that relate to work being done by the Wellcome Institute and the Rockefeller Foundation?
Well, I could talk about the Institute and the Foundation at length for you, because I know a lot about those elitist operations and the plans they have for this Earth and this world, and this thing called governance, which they would like to be global and under one leader. But regarding the rest of the question from the great listener, I probably don't feel qualified enough to answer it directly and accurately, so I'll probably pass on that.
Okay, well, thank you anyway. And then we have another question from the chat room dealing with the Earth's tilt. Some researchers say the angle of the tilt of the Earth has increased from 23 degrees to something like 43 degrees. Any comments? And I do believe this has a lot to do with the so-called global warming issue.
Yes, it's true. The current tilt of the Earth is 23.4 degrees, but as the listener mentioned, it's in a state of gradual change. It's constantly shifting between 21.5 degrees to 24.5 degrees, and this takes place every 41,000 years. And this is known as the obliquity cycle, and I talk about it in the book, and again, I just try to keep it really simple. So these changes in pitch, which the listener's referring to, obviously impact the seasonal weather on the Earth, with summers and winters becoming more extreme as the hemisphere, in fact, I'm just going to go to my book because I worked really hard to write this portion of the book. So here we go. These changes in pitch obviously impact the seasonal weather, with summers and winters becoming more extreme as the hemispheres lean closer or farther from the sun. Presently, the Earth is in a decreasing obliquity cycle, so that means it's moving back towards the lesser cant of 21.5 degrees, which will eventually produce cooler summers and milder winters. And this cycle can't be stopped. So you're right. The tilt of the Earth is constantly changing. Not a lot, but it's changing. And enough of a change so that it does impact our weather. So despite what Al Gore tells you, despite what anybody tells you, it's just a matter of time before we automatically, just based on the tilt of the Earth, see cooler summers and milder winters.
Well, I heard that there's a trend, a cooling trend right now globally, which would actually counter what the climate change people are stating.
Yes. It's interesting because this is what the global warmers don't want you to know. Again, as I mentioned, it hasn't warmed since 1998. And they're trying to phony up the records to make it seem as if this is the warmest weather ever. The warmest decade, I might add, in history was the 1930s, not these past 10 years. But here's what they're doing. Even though we have cooled a bit in these last couple of years, they're taking the temperature readings of the Earth and playing with them. So here's how they're doing it. I heard April was the hottest month ever. Okay, well, that was garbage. I heard 2009 was the hottest year ever. Then they said it was the fourth hottest year ever. Well, it's probably not even in the top 20. But the bottom line is they've taken temperature readings that we used to use to determine the temperature from Canada and from Siberia and from some of the high mountainous areas of the world. They've taken those temperature readings and thrown them out. So they've taken cold readings and thrown them out because they want the land temperature to appear warmer. And then, right now, more than ever, they're relying more heavily on ocean-based temperatures. Well, those of us who live near the Pacific Ocean can tell you the water in the Pacific right now is warmer because of something called El Niño. It happens every 10 years or so. It's a change of the ocean currents, and the water just warms up. We don't really know why it occurs, but it does. And it makes for warmer ocean temperatures. So they're taking more of those ocean temperatures, which are warmer, factoring them in with the land temperatures, which they've made warmer by dumping cooler temperature readings. And they've come up with these, 2009, oh my God, this is the hottest year ever. April 2010, warmest year ever. Well, it's just not true. It's not true. How do I know that? Well, look at the satellite data. Satellites do a wonderful job of measuring the temperature of the Earth. They're very consistent, very uniform, wonderful. I know the guys who run the temperature unit at University of Alabama Huntsville. That's where they do it, and they will tell you that 2009 didn't even crack the top 20. April 2010, well, hot? What are you talking about? We're looking at the data. It's not hot. Well, if it is hot, if you're manipulating the data the way Jim Hansen from NASA is doing, and the way Phil Jones from the University of East Anglia in the UK is doing, these are left-wing political hacks with a socialist agenda, and that's why they're skewing the temperature, because they want Obama to get his wish, and they want Al Gore to get his money. That's what they want.
Well, and I have two questions, and they both relate to each other. One is from Lily in the chat room, and the other one is from Jared in the chat room. The first one from Lily is, how would you suggest that we protect the environment and this world we live in? And the second one pertains to the oil spill in the Gulf. How are fishermen sucking it up?
Yeah, let's talk about how would we protect the environment in which we live. Listen, I love the environment. I'm speaking to you right now from a studio that I have right next to the Pacific Ocean. I could literally get off this phone and I could walk to the water's edge in probably 3 minutes. I love the ocean. I'm out in it all the time. I dig it. I love hiking. I love biking. I love climbing. I love all this. I love the outdoors. I love clean air. I love clean water. And I thank God that here in the United States we have both. Our rivers and our oceans are in wonderful state. Our skies are perfectly clean. I've lived in California most of my life. I remember when I was a kid in the 60s and 70s, the air pollution in the Los Angeles basin was just unbelievable. 300 days a year it was unhealthy. Guess what? Even though there are more people now, more cars now, more houses now, more energy being consumed now, in the L.A. basin, despite even stricter standards, we have about, 5, 10 days a year where the air is unhealthy. That's all. That's all. It used to be 300. Now we have 5, 6, 7. That's about it. Same thing in the Silicon Valley of the San Francisco Bay Area. The air has been cleaned up. So we have done a remarkable job of hitting all the benchmarks which were originally established in the Clean Air Act of 1970. Those six pollutants have been cleaned up. We should get an award for this, as opposed to China and India and Brazil, where they're polluting the skies all to hell. They can really give a rip. Here in this country, we care. We've done a wonderful job. We've done the same thing with our water. And I'm not talking about our drinking water supply. That's a different story. But I'm talking about just the water in our rivers and our oceans and our lakes. We've done a wonderful job of cleaning those up. So, listen, I'm all for that. The problem is CO2 and greenhouse gases are not a pollutant. They're not. They're not a pollutant. But they've been made to look as if they're bad when, in fact, I've got news for you. Without the greenhouse effect, this Earth would be a ball of ice. You should be very thankful. If you believe in a God, you should thank God for that greenhouse effect, because otherwise this Earth would be uninhabitable. And basically, we could actually withstand a little warming. And we could certainly withstand a lot more CO2 in the atmosphere, because the plants absolutely love it. Now, the second question is, what's happening with this Gulf oil spill, and are certain elements sucking it up? Absolutely. Katrina, what a big waste of money that was. We spent hundreds of billions of dollars, I believe, at the end of the day in terms of relief for Katrina victims. I had one of my kids working with a school project that went down to Mississippi to build homes. This was about 3 years ago, and so it was just a couple years after Katrina. And my son said he was building, helping refurbish this house, and he said, he described the people living in the house, and he said, Dad, you basically had, these were low-income individuals. He called them, kind of white trash people. And they got their Katrina check every month. They'd get a Katrina check every month. A Katrina check every month. And what would the lady of the household do with her Katrina check? First thing she'd do is go buy her cigarettes, go buy some beer, and then go play bingo. That's how she was spending her Katrina check. And this is how probably thousands of people are spending their Katrina checks. Now, how are people going to do this with the BP oil spill? Oh, they're going to file claims that aren't valid, claims that are illegitimate, claims filled fraud, and we'll pay it out because that's what we do. Our government will hand out money to anybody. And so that's what they plan on doing. So you've got a lot of fishermen, a lot of people that have been down on their luck, not having a great year. They're going to take advantage of this crisis as well. And the federal government will be okay with that, because they know once those people receive that check, guess what? They got a vote. They've got a vote. And that's what a lot of this is all about, political motivations. What did I tell you earlier in the broadcast? I quoted from John Holdren, and this is in my book. It's in the foreword, page XVI of the foreword. He said, this effort must be largely political. What is more political than a handout after a catastrophe? Give the money to people, shut them up, they'll be your friends for life.
And they'll vote for Democratic congressmen and incumbents come November.
Yes, 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 and that's exactly what they want. They want to try maintain as many of these seats in the Senate and House as possible, because they know they're on the ropes, and they know that there are many good women and good men running for office for the first time who are great patriots who want to take this country back. Now, in closing, good Paul, let me just share something with you from my book here, because I think this is a great little story to wrap it up. And it's been a wonderful excursion tonight on your broadcast. I received a letter. You receive emails, you receive letters from your listeners, and sometimes, as you know, they're quite moving. I received a letter some time ago from a listener, a gentleman named Alan. And he said, "Brian, I want to tell you about my hero. My hero's name is Stan." And he went into this letter, and Alan and Stan were young kids during World War II, and they decided to join the Army together, and they had their training at the same location, and then they had their first assignment overseas in the same company, and basically they went through all of World War II together. These were kids that grew up together and served together in World War II, and that's very, very unusual. And at the Battle of the Bulge, Stan took a bullet to the spine and was paralyzed. And so Alan said, "You know, I just want to tell you about my hero, Stan, because he was paralyzed in the Battle of the Bulge, and he never once complained. And he went on to marry a beautiful woman, and they had a beautiful child that they adopted, and he became a wonderful businessman. And Brian, he's never complained." And Alan told me, he said, "I was just a survivor." He said, "Listen, I had the life scared out of me at the Battle of the Bulge. I was freezing cold. I was afraid of the Germans." He said, I survived. I was not a hero." So now I'm going to read you something from my book. I phoned Alan, and I invited him to be a guest on my radio program. He accepted, and we had a most remarkable and enlightening conversation. Alan described in detail Stan's character, the courage of his fellow soldiers, the showmanship of General Patton, the gut-wrenching liberation of the Mauthausen concentration camp. And towards the end of our phone conversation, I asked Alan about the present condition of America as he saw us racing towards unprecedented government expansion, unpayable debt, and liberty-sapping politics. "You've lived a very full life, Alan. You've seen it all. You've dodged Nazi bullets, shed tears at Mauthausen, returned home a hero, raised a beautiful family with your wife, and now you're witnessing your very country being so deceived." And Alan said, "Brian, 98, and the U.S. is Germany. We're in a situation right now where our country is being torn asunder, and this is a plot, this is a scheme that has been long in the making. And Paul, that's why I appreciate guys like you, you know, taking time out of your day, out of your life, to put together broadcasts like this, to talk about things that seem unbelievable, but in fact are based in fact and are worthy of discussion. That's why I make the switch from television to radio, because I want to talk about these things. That's why my wife cut me loose to take about 18 months of my life to write the book Climate Gate, because we need to get the word out of what these people are trying to do to us. It's not good. This is like Germany. And you can make all the analogies you want, but at the end of the day, they want to change the way in which we live. So I highly encourage your great listeners to go to Amazon, go wherever, buy the book ClimateGate. We need to get the word out. We need to stop this Senate energy bill. And I really appreciate the time to be on your program tonight, my friend.
And could you give my... And by the way, I had a few more questions from the listeners, but we don't have time tonight. Can they email you those questions?
Yes.
That they may have had that we weren't able to get to tonight.
Yes, please. Just go to debatemealgore.com, debatemealgore.com, and there's an email mechanism there. And there's a lot of great articles I've written and a lot more about the book and about me. Another way you could do it, maybe even more simply, is debatemealgore@yahoo.com.
Okay, and I want to thank you again for being on the show tonight. And if you'll give me an opportunity after the show is off air, is there any way that I could call you back to try to get schedule you to come back at a later date?
Yes, good man. I really appreciate that. I think your producer has my phone number, so let's use that as an opportunity to reconnect. And thank you for all you're doing.
Well, thank you, and everybody. Please support him by buying the book, if you would, and by also going to Dr. Sussman's website. Let's see that Dr. Sussman is able to get that debate with Al Gore to open up a free and intelligent dialogue about the truth of global warming. And I want to thank all of you for listening to the show tonight. Remember, you will find the truth here. What you do with it is up to you, and also do something with it. Don't sit on your hands. Be active. Thank you again. God bless you, and good night.